Tonight, we are so fortunate to have the artist Kamruz Aram here in anticipation of Focus Kamruz Aram, which opens to the public this weekend. Kamruz was born in Shiraz, Iran. He received his MFA from Columbia in 2003 and now lives and works in Brooklyn. His exhibition record is significant and in keeping with concerns of his art. For example, his exhibition Ornament and Indifferent Architecture at the Museum of Dant de Dahens, and I'm not sure I really butchered that. I even put pronunciation out here, but I can't make out my pronunciation. My apologies. Which is in Belgium. It was this past year. Or Recollections for a Room at the Green Art Gallery in Dubai in 2016. He had an earlier exhibition at Green Art Gallery in 2014, for which was produced a lovely book, which is available in the Modern Store, titled Kamruz Aram, Unstable Paintings for Anxious Interiors. His titles slay me. He has me at the title. And most recently, his exhibition at the Atlanta Contemporary in Atlanta, Georgia, closes this weekend, just, of course, as this show opens here. Earlier in his career, Kamruz was included in the landmark PS1 MoMA Greater New York of 2005, as well as the Prague Biennale 1 in 2003. Kamruz has been recognized with awards and fellowships, including most recently being shortlisted for the 2018 Jamal Prize, which is given by the Victoria and Albert Museum along with Art Jamal. His work is in interesting public and private collections, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, which seems like a perfect fit to me. Kamruz's practice has been described as inviting viewers to reconsider conventional definitions of ornament and the decorative, insisting that the same kind of meaning can be found in ornamental forms as one would find in abstract painting. It has been noted that his paintings reveal the essential role that ornament played in the development of modern art in the West, as well as considering the constructed neutrality of museum displays as a primary site of encountering artworks. I find the work a beautiful blend of the pragmatic and the poetic. It is perfection that cultivates nuanced disruptions, all of which is making for the most intriguing and beautiful installation taking shape in Gallery 6 on the first floor. Tonight, we gain insight into the exhibition Kamruz has conceived for this museum, as well as putting that work into context as he shares his larger practice. Please join me in welcoming Kamruz Aram.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that super nice introduction, and thank you all for being here. Somehow your introduction made me less nervous. You're so comfortable up here. I dislike public speaking. I also just want to thank everybody at this museum. It's been a really wonderful experience working with the staff here, from the curatorial staff to the preparatory staff, who have been just beyond expectation. So thank you all for hosting me this week. I guess we can dim the lights and get started. Usually, I've gone back and forth between sort of responding to the work myself and kind of improvising in these talks and actually writing a lecture. So tonight, I think I'm going to try something in between and see how it pans out. Some of you may recognize this painting. It's not one of mine. And I'll read you a little text. A clay painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned toward the past, where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe, which keeps piling wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But a storm is blowing in from paradise. It has caught in his wings with such a violence that the angel can no longer close them. The storm is irresistibly propelling him toward the future, to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress. That's Walter Benjamin. Some of you might recognize that from the thesis on the philosophy of history. I just read it, so we don't need to keep that up. This is a painting of my own, which is in response to Benjamin's text, actually. And maybe it's relevant to start this talk with the excerpt from Walter Benjamin as well as this painting, because I'm kind of breaking with the linear, you know, chronological order of these presentations. Typically, you start like at the beginning and kind of work through the work. So what you'll see is kind of all over the place. This is a house that was designed by Adolf Loos just 10 years after that clay painting, which was made in 1920. So this is the Villa Müller in Prague from 1930. Loos was an architect who was best known for Ornament and Crime, his 1910 lecture, which was published as an essay in 1913. In this text, Loos sets the stage for modernist architecture by insisting that ornament must be removed from all architecture, and really any art form. And his proto-modernist position can also be seen as proto-fascist. He proclaims that while ornament is acceptable for criminals with tattoos, remember this is back in 1910, and those backward cultures in the East, it is not appropriate for the modern Western aristocrat. Of course, inside the house, it's worth noting the Persian carpet. And Persian carpets, in fact, have been something important to me from early on. I had come to see Persian carpets as a parallel to painting. They're rectangular, flat objects that we live with. They're displayed in interiors and often have content that is either symbolic or otherwise, despite their reputation for being seen as purely decorative. And the decorative is something else that I want to talk about a little bit tonight. All of the pejoratives that are ascribed to Persian carpets can also be ascribed to modernist painting. And graffiti has also become a form of ornament in the urban landscape. Cities and landlords have countered this ornament with a sort of cover-up. These gestures where the landlord kind of sends somebody out to try to neutralize the graffiti. Something that I find really interesting about this gesture is that Cy Twombly is an artist that I've always been interested in, and he was after this uninhibited mark, this mark that is the most natural mark, maybe, is what he was looking for. And I think that something about this cover-up is that it's a form of labor, and yet there's an intuition to it. These people that are covering up are told to just go get rid of the graffiti, and it's automatic, but I think there's something more to it. I debated whether or not I'm going to read this text. It's in the book that that Terry mentioned in the bookstore, but I think I'll read it. It's something that I wrote in reference to the cover-up, which is found internationally. The pictures that I'm showing right now are all photographs that I've taken either in Brooklyn or in Istanbul. So this little bit of writing kind of takes you through both of those geographical locations. It's called The Cover-Up. 1. A short drive up Flushing Avenue, past Oriental Lumber and the monolithic chicken processing plant, the evidence remains. The pong of rotting meat, the broken window panes left unrepaired, the puddles of liquid death filling every corner, and an apathetic coat of something close to yellow thrown over the whole mess. A few smack-headed wanderers pulling two caboose trains of shopping carts carrying junky treasures to some mysterious place of business. Grisly truck drivers pushing their monstrosities through the clogged arteries of this forsaken beast, occasionally taking a youth to another place, late in the evening or early in the morning, leaving a white bicycle to commemorate the occasion. Even on an overcast day with Miles Davis's Porgy and Bess blasting through fuzzy old car speakers, it is hard to get romantic about this scene, the way we did in Baltimore, our youthful heads aflame and eyes burning with longing. Here, somewhere between Bushwick and Masbeth, some road to Middle Village, hidden away from the comforting post-war two-family homes of Ridgewood, some overpass, some underpass, some place in between, here is where a youth has found the indeterminate need to make a mark. And here is where the department of this or that has attempted to take the mark away. But erasure always leaves its own mark. The evidence remains and the youth's mark is not gone, but altered. And again, some time later, this youth or that youth marks the spot, and again, the department of this or that marks the youth. Two. The youth makes an exigent mark. Urgency is different here. No one is alone. Apathy is not an option. The mark must be made. The mark must be covered. And again, the department here is bigger than this or that. A hasty early morning walk down Istiklal and commuters put their lackadaisical shoulders to the wheel. The tourists are sleeping, the shutters are drawn. Where noise has been made, where voices went raw and faded into a raspy whisper, where tourists have had ice cream cones cleverly placed in their shirt pockets daily by tactful teens who have served enough cones at their young age to have acquired such banal skills, where the 12-year-old boy wanders from this group of buskers to that with his drum, sometimes borrowing theirs, and quietly but determinedly playing along, where the sunken-eyed, overworked girl who seems to be standing behind the counter at every Simit Soraya in Beyoğlu reminds me of the meth-headed mother of death I met in North Adams, Massachusetts, during the snowy January of 2006, who made me a bagel and a coffee each morning as I sniffled away cold, hopped up on pseudoephedrine, trying not to look at her bony hands on my bread. Where a woman plays a concertina every night, kneeling with a sideways tilt, playing the same two or three notes in haunting repetition. Di-da-di-da, 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 di-da-di-da. Where despite my Eastern complexion and elegant mustache, I am invited by sleazy fixers, scam artists, and pimps to go drink in their bars and meet their girls. Where the grilled corn on the street is dry and chalky, where defeated old dogs keep quiet in the corners, hopelessly awaiting a sympathetic morsel from a tourist's midnight snack. Where young men and women stand in armor watching all of this from another world, as if on television. Where the tourists ignore these ghosts, their water cannon tanks drifting down the center of the street, passing right through the hordes of Arabs, Iranians, Europeans, and East Asians, only sending a slight shiver down spines like a cool breeze extracted from the darkest depths of the Bosphorus. A hasty morning walk, and the light of blue skies has covered up what was visible late in the evening. This town is painted over. This was written right after I visited Istanbul, which was right around the Gezi Park protests. I don't know if some of you followed that. And eventually, I managed to catch up with the painters themselves. Something that I might mention is that many of the paintings that I'm about to show are titled palimpsest paintings. And for those of you who are not familiar with that term, a palimpsest is a tablet that was often coated with wax, which was written upon and then scraped down and reused. So while the final text was dominant, traces of the previous layers could be seen, thus revealing the history of the tablet itself. In my use of the term, in reference to these paintings, I'd like to evoke the idea that these paintings reveal their own history, and I almost like to think of these paintings as a sort of history painting. This one's titled Untold Stories from 2013. Also Untold Stories. It might be worth noting that the process for these paintings is quite similar to some of the paintings that you'll see in the galleries here, which is that each painting starts with a pattern from a Persian carpet. Back in, I guess it was around 2001 when I first moved to New York and started graduate school, I started looking at Persian carpets in Persian carpet stores. It was the location that was where there were the most kind of commodified and the most sort of devoid of their content. And I photographed the carpets, and I would take these details of the carpets and project them onto the canvas, and that would be the starting point for the painting. And all of these paintings, as well as the ones that you'll see, which are very different in the galleries here, the painting started with usually a grid on the canvas on which I would draw the detail of the Persian carpet with an oil crayon. This is called Masbeth Ritual from 2013. These paintings are 84 by 72 inches. So that's 7 by 6 feet. Not quite as big as you see them up there. Some of them are a little bit smaller as well. I do tend to go rather quickly through the slides because I have a lot of them. And hopefully that'll be more entertaining. Tempered composition with 3 points. Revision for a nostalgic garden. Backdrop for the structural harmony of a city. The title of the show, Unstable Paintings for Anxious Interiors, for me refers to several things. It has a little bit to do with my own anxiety about painting, and every painter's anxiety about painting kind of becoming a decorative object. And at some point, I think I learned to let that go and embrace the idea that a painting has a partial role as a decorative object. The same way that we might be listening to music actively, we go to a concert or you put on a record and you sit there and you listen to the lyrics and the music has content and you're directly engaging with that content. And other times the music is on in a restaurant or in a car and you're not really listening, but it's affecting your environment in some way. And so I thought it would be maybe cheeky to title the show Unstable Paintings for Anxious Interiors, charging the interiors where they will be living the rest of their lives. Also, the paintings are rather unstable. So, especially the ones in this show, so please do not touch. For those of you who paint, the effect of washing them down with solvent, the idea that I'm drawing with an oil crayon and then washing that down, leaves very little binding the pigment to the canvas, so it can be wiped away. And I'm jumping around quite a bit tonight, but it'll settle down a little bit once I kind of set out enough breadcrumbs for the whole thing to make sense. The series Ancient Through Modern takes its title from an art history course that I took when I was in college, and I keep thinking that I must be remembering this, the title of the course incorrectly, because Ancient Through Modern sounds like super ambitious. It may have been Ancient Through Gothic, but I like Ancient Through Modern because, well, I'll get to that. The collages were made using several mid-century books documenting Iranian art in particular. And my only rule when I collect the books is that they were published before 1978. 1978 was the year that Edward Said published Orientalism. 1979, technically. I guess he wrote it up until that point. I think 1979 is the publishing date, so I can be a little flexible. With these works, I was really thinking about the ways in which these objects are displayed or imaged in the books. One of the things that I took away very early on from Edward Said's Orientalism was the question of representation and how one culture is represented by another. And so when looking at these books, which were exclusively published in Western countries, mostly the U.S. and Italy and the U.K. I do have one from Russia as well. But thinking about how the photography, the color of the backdrops they use, the book design, all affects how we kind of look at these objects. One particular book called 7,000 Years of Iranian Art was a catalog for an exhibition that was objects loaned by the Iranian government to the U.S. and were toured several encyclopedic museums in the U.S. I became interested in this book in particular because that title, 7,000 Years of Iranian Art, is like both nostalgic and sort of intimidating. And I think that it was both a gesture of cultural exchange and diplomacy and a gesture of intimidation, you know, for a country that was much, much younger than 7,000 years. The goal for me was to try to situate these collages somehow in one of these encyclopedic museums, which proved to be difficult because I think it's most of the encyclopedic museums have a different conversation about contemporary art than a modern or contemporary museum like this one. So as I was kind of looking at the vitrines in the museums and kind of studying the encyclopedic museums themselves, this one is at the Met, as is this one, I started thinking about how I could maybe bring the museum to the work itself rather than the other way around. I'm not sure if anybody is familiar with this photograph, but it's by Cecil Beaton, and it's a model posing in front of a Jackson Pollock from his 1950 exhibition at Betty Parsons Gallery, and the photographs were published in Vogue magazine in the March of 1951. Some of what I've already said about the painting kind of as a decorative object or as a backdrop becomes relevant here. The art historian T.J. Clark wrote about this. This is what he said. Beaton had ideas about how the pictures and dresses matched. He reveled in the analogy between lavender mist's powdery transparency, or the transparency his lighting gave it, and of the chiffon and fan. The fan struck a Whistlerian note. He tweaked Irene's black cocktail dress into a to and fro of diagonals, which made it quite plausibly part of Jackson Pollock's autumn rhythm behind it, and so on. The effects are not subtle and did not need to be. Hedging his bets just a little, the Vogue sub-editor informed readers that the dazzling and curious paintings of Jackson Pollock, which are in the photographs of these four pages, almost always cause an intensity of feelings. There's a lot there. There's a lot there for me. I am interested in an intensity of feelings in art. You know, I'm not shy to mention that. But also, it's kind of a precursor of like our selfie culture. One of the things that really irritates me is when people kind of pose in front of a work rather than, you know, looking at the work that they turn their back to the work and take a picture of themselves in front of the work. I almost said no judgment if anybody in here has done that, but actually, I don't know. I think judgment if you've done that. A friend of mine took a picture of his daughter looking at her favorite work from behind, which I thought was beautiful. You know, she was actually looking at the work. This, I caught a kind of somebody without a permit shooting at MoMA in front of this Rauschenberg. And so I did my own in the studio with a friend of mine, just for fun. But the idea of the painting as the backdrop and the kind of figure-ground relationship between a person and a painting was something that I saw in the museum vitrines as well. So my first attempt at kind of bringing the collages into the context of the museum was this work, in which I hung the paintings, the collages directly onto an abstract painting, basically a minimalist painting, a geometric abstraction. And so in this case, the painting, the abstract painting, becomes the backdrop for, or the even the wall, the support for the collages, which are made from images of artworks that are deemed minor decorative. And that led back into bringing linen into the collages and working with the collages as paintings themselves, which is present in these few paintings here. Most of my work, I think, requires seeing it in person. So it's difficult to explain what's happening physically in front of your eyes. With these works, I found a series of books that were, I think they're all offset lithograph from the 1950s. And the black is so rich and so matte that it really just absorbs all of the light in the room. It's hard to kind of show that with these. In these works, I would sort of take an image and respond to it with painting. So there would be a sort of a call and response, the call being the image out of the book and the response being my own kind of interpretation of an abstract form responding to that image. The materials are mostly the actual book pages and acrylic paint, maybe sometimes oil paint and pencil, but also sometimes book cloth. So the red that you see behind the image from the book is actually book cloth, which is what, you know, bookmakers bind books with. The first opportunity that I had to actually work with objects and some extraordinary objects was when I was awarded a prize which really functions as a commission called the Abraj Prize based in Dubai. And they give you a lot of money and you can produce an artwork in which that goes into their collection. That's when I made Ancient Through Modern, a collection of uncertain objects in 2014. None of these works have any kind of didactic text, as you'll notice in the galleries here. There's nothing telling you where the objects came from. I'm interested in sort of presenting them in a way that allows them to kind of do their own work, allows you to maybe disconnect from the cultural nostalgia, the longing for the past, this kind of expectation that these things are important because they're old. So some of the objects are genuine antiquities, some of them are replicas of antiquities, some of them are objects that are mid-century antiques, some are more significant than others, some of them I bought at the museum gift shop, some of them I commissioned, some of them I made myself, but there's nothing kind of revealing what which is which. And this was the first time that I kind of started to think about exhibition design as a medium. one of these objects will look very familiar to you. Some of you. You can see that the pedestals even become sculptural. I actually worked with a mount maker at the Met to make some of the mounts, for example, for this piece, the mount that holds that blue bowl. I learned a lot from him about the kind of techniques that the mount makers at these museums use. And going back to the museum itself, this is a photograph that I took at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Perhaps I can give you a little bit of context for what I'm thinking about in the museum. Something that was that became abundantly clear to me as a young person is that when you go to the museum with other Iranians, they go straight for the Persian, ancient Persian, and there's this kind of romanticization of the past. And I think that there's a that's what I started to refer to as cultural nostalgia. Many cultures have it. If you go to a place like the Met and you'll see Chinese people in the ancient Chinese, you'll see Japanese people and, checking out the Nakashima table. Like, you have this kind of cultural affinity, right? You want to check out what your people did. With Iranians, I think because a lot of Iranians living in the U.S. have a dim perspective on what's going on in Iran today, they look at the past as their glorious past, right? And so that's a form of cultural nostalgia, where we go to the museum and long for when we were a great civilization and brag about it in books like 7,000 Years of Iranian Art. But what I started kind of thinking about after having looked at those books was that in the museum itself, you're not really looking at the past. You're looking at the present. You're looking at contemporary objects. What you're looking at here is the head of a bull that was carved and displayed with many, many other heads of bulls in at the top of columns, right? And what we're looking at is the way that it's lit, these shadows, the mount that is holding it, which is really beautifully designed, actually. It's a really special moment in the museum. But we see this as this kind of colorless, minimalist object, right? And that's how we want to see it. But the truth of the matter is that in its original context, it was painted with super bright colors, like you would see maybe bright pinks and blues, and it would maybe look more Vegas than we would like to think, you know? So I think it's interesting to kind of think about how we make the museum a certain aesthetic that we long for in a museum. And as I was kind of taking these photographs and while I was visiting museums, especially in my research phase for that previous work that I just showed you, I thought about going back to that moment of documentation, that time when the photographer and the book designers kind of decide how to represent these objects. I thought, well, let me perhaps take back that representation and to my own hands. So this series of photographs was called Ancient Through Modern, an Uncertain Record for Future Nostalgia. I'm dying to tell you what these things are, but I'm not going to. I'm disciplined. What's that? No. I can tell you what these are. Postcards. They're cards, because they're not postcards, technically. From Turkey. It's one of those moments where I feel like a little bit guilty because they're so beautiful by themselves. I didn't really do anything, you know? Okay, another chapter. Some of you may know that Josephine Baker and Le Corbusier met on the Lutetia, which was a ship coming from Brazil, in 1929. On the ship, a lot of things happened between the two of them. They had an affair, and there is another photograph of a kind of carnivalesque scene where Le Corbusier is actually dressed up as Baker in blackface. Corbusier's fascist tendencies a decade later are perhaps the subject for somebody else's lecture, but suffice it to say that Josephine Baker was the subject of adoration and fetishization of many modernist negrophiliac artists and kind of architects and cultural folks, including Adolf Loos, who I mentioned before. The stripes that you see, I kind of put the cart ahead of the horse here, but the stripes that you see in this work are a reference to Adolf Loos and a house that he designed for Josephine Baker. Some of my first kind of opportunities to play with exhibition design were at art fairs, and I know that a lot of artists like to pretend that they hate art fairs. Art fairs often pay the bills, but they also allow for experimentation, if you're brave enough, to do something that's outside the ordinary. So we did this in Lista in Basel. There are very few galleries or museums where you can do something this small and take this kind of risk. The representation of ancient objects in modernist art is obviously something that, from Brancusi to Picasso was prevalent. But I think it's also worth noting that the era of archaeology, the first kind of archaeological digs, which were often done by Europeans in the East, took place right around the time, I think, that, the turn of the century. I guess like they would have started in the late 1800s and been in full effect in the early 20th century. I believe that it's unquestionable that there was a relationship between modernism and archaeology. And this is the house that Loos designed for Josephine Baker. It was never built. This is just a photograph of a model. And it's questionable whether the two even met. Some writings have claimed that Loos's wife said that they met at a party and that she expressed that she was unhappy with the house that was being designed for her. And he said, well, I'm an architect and I'll design a house just for you. Either way, it's a dubious situation. There's been a lot of writing on this, but inside the house there's a swimming pool. In old Iranian houses, we have this, the private quarters and the public quarters, right? So they had the private quarters and the private quarters in this house set out. In the public quarters, was at the center of the house, was a swimming pool in which, when Baker would be swimming, viewers could look on as if they were looking in an aquarium and watch her swimming. Furthermore, the stripes on the outside, which were meant to be black and white marble, are clearly a form of ornament, and I think Los probably thought that it was good for somebody who he probably would think of as a savage. The savage is the word that they would use. So after many years of rearranging this work, I finally, in the past year, came to this composition, which is called Josephine and the Architect. The ceramic work, I will tell you what it is because I think it's relevant, is by a designer who worked for Michael Anderson Company in Denmark. I believe she was German by birth, called Marianne Stark. And she did a series called the Persia Glaze series, which I think actually may have predated her position at the Michael Anderson Company. But she also did her own series called the Tribal series, also known as the Negro series. It's not uncommon when you look at these kind of mid-century ceramics to find this kind of thing, but it's interesting to me how in-depth this series was for Marianne Stark, and when you compare it to the rest of her work. There was clearly a kind of obsession or fetishization or exoticization of the black body as well as African art. The materials are, it's an oil painting with the ceramic in front of it on a walnut pedestal with brass and terrazzo. Terrazzo is a, are you familiar with terrazzo? It's a material that's ground marble. It started in Venice when the workers would gather the kind of crumbs from the marble and reuse them in a kind of concrete and pour them and grind them and polish them. Eventually, they started dividing them with brass, and it became a form of painting, actually, I think. It's quite sad, I think, this piece. I'll give you a moment to read this. This is from the book of interviews with Michael Alping and Tadao Ando that Allison gave me when I first agreed to do this project. And I read the book cover to cover pretty quickly and found that I was so excited that Ando had so many thoughts that were in common with how I think about space. And this really struck me as an architect who understands that when he designs a building for art, it is not going to be a neutral context for the work, but that that there needs to be a balance between the architecture and the work. Another architect who I've looked at, I don't actually know Ando's work very well, but Carlos Scarpa is an architect who's from Italy, no longer alive. He died on a scaffold in Japan in 1978. Which is the year I was born. In Venice, it was really difficult to make new work as an architect. Not only were the building laws really strict in terms of how you can alter buildings, but there's no space to build anything new. So for this reason, I believe that Scarpa was destined to renovate old buildings. He started working a lot with museums, and he renovated a lot of museums. If you find yourself in Venice, the one of the buildings that's really worth checking out is right in San Marco Square. It's the Olivetti showroom, which is kind of like the what the Apple store would have been like 80 years ago, the typewriter company Olivetti. It's an astonishing piece of architecture. He also renovated the Correr Museum, which is in San Marco Square. It's like the second level museum that kind of goes around the square. When I say he renovated, he did the exhibition design, he designed easels, he designed mounts. This room is Scarpa's work. This room is also Scarpa's work, where the paintings are actually embedded in travertine. And you can see by the notches that in the travertine that he was not afraid of ornament. And his frequent visits to Japan, of course. This is something that I've talked about before, which is the this magical moment that I found with this piece, where the pencil lines that the workers had made to kind of make this cut were never erased, and this kind of functional mark that demarcates a space becomes expressive in a way, you know, and it's something that I had been doing to an extent, but once I saw this, I really kind of, it gave me a freedom to be able to work with the functional mark. It goes back to something that I was saying about that cover-up of the graffiti, that it's a functional mark that actually becomes expressive in some way. This is a Scarpa at the Castelvecchio Museum in Verona. This is all stucco lustro, the Venetian plaster. And the pedestals below, that kind of T shape with the notch in it, you know, had to kind of interact with the work without disrupting it, but without trying to be neutral, with the understanding that it's still Scarpa, that it's still modernist. This is Palazzo Abatelis in Palermo. Such a special... I finally got to this place last year. I've seen every major Scarpa work now. This was the last one. I believe in an emotional architecture. It is very important for humankind that architecture should move by its beauty. If there are many equally valid technical solutions to a problem, the one that offers the user a message of beauty and emotion, that one is architecture. Luis Barragán. These are my people. This is like my language. You know, when I was in graduate school, it was so, you know, from 2001 to 2003, these kinds of terms in art were really frowned upon. You know, you start making abstract paintings and somebody says, well, that looks like you could have a Greenbergian conversation about it. You know, like Greenberg was the devil. And he was interesting. He was like a really interesting thinker, not to be overlooked. You know, there were some problems, but... sort of responding to Barragán's call for an emotional architecture, I was thinking about the idea of ornament and how all ornament is devoid of content. Some artwork could be considered a form of ornament itself, right? Artwork kind of sits in an interior, often filling a space, often becoming a backdrop, but also perhaps charges that environment emotionally or poetically somehow. Like I said earlier about music, you know, maybe you're not constantly critically engaged with it, you're not constantly unpacking the semiotics, but it's just its presence changes the emotion of that space. So the title Ornaments for Indifferent Architecture is a play on that. You know, what is the opposite of emotional architecture? It's banal architecture, indifferent architecture. Of course, the museum where this show was is not really indifferent, and of course this museum is absolutely not indifferent. That's why One of the paintings, when you first walk into the gallery, you see a triptych. It's called Ornament for Extraordinary Architecture. I made it for this building. And this is at the Museum d'Antalanens in Belgium. It's the first time that I was able to show in completely natural light. All these photographs were taken with only natural light. The space itself, without anything in it, is astonishing. It's really difficult to kind of show you these paintings in reproduction. The paintings were made using a plaster knife and sort of like a stucco lustro technique almost, you know, working over with a paint that was dissolved in oil and wax in thin layers and kind of building it up so that it shimmers. I think there are a couple of details where maybe you can see a little more information. Again, that's another form of labor, you know, using a plaster knife, like skim coating the painting, and digging back into it with pencil marks. This is a really good projector. And this piece, which is titled A Monument for Living in Defeat. There's an interdependence between the sculptures, the paintings, and the pedestals, and in this case, the floor. Everything kind of depends on each other. Nothing exists autonomously. The painting can never be seen as a painting on its own. The sculpture can never be seen without the painting behind it. The pedestal can never be seen without the terrazzo floor below it. Luckily, my friend who fabricates this stuff is as obsessed with detail as Scarpa himself. Something that I really enjoy after I install one of these shows is like actually, somebody asked me earlier if I was okay with permitting photography in the gallery, and I encourage it because I really, what happens for me is like all these surprises, right? So, I think it's so much the way that this building functions. Like every time I walk out with Allison coming out of the galleries and there's that elliptical curve of the concrete, and as I'm walking, it's like if I was filming it, every still would be a perfect picture, you know? And I think that something that happens working with exhibition design is that you find these moments that are really magical. And I don't, you know, I don't shy away from like things that are functional. Like this door there is beautiful to me. You know, there's no need to hide it. I think I might go a little bit over time. Is that okay? I should ask you all instead of. If you get bored, you can leave. So great to see you this big. The perspective is skewed, so it looks normal, right? I should be looking down here. Another example of the functional is that there was this steel corner here where the black is, and it was thicker than my normal black stripes, which are about 2 inches, and I just kind of went for it and wanted to embrace that moment. Okay, finally. This is a hotel that Joe Ponti designed in Sorrento. It's called the Parco dei Principi. This is a view from below. And I had the privilege of visiting about a year ago. Everything is considered, the way I think it has so much in common with this building. I just adore this restaurant over here and the way that it's designed, the furniture and the way that you sort of sit in the water while you're dining, and the way that you have all types of banal people going in there, like myself, and we just sit there and we look beautiful in this space. It's just it really enhances everything. And I think this is what I experienced with this building in Sorrento. He designed all of the furniture, and I just thought to myself, that's so it's so interesting how an architect or a designer is so comfortable coming up with a color scheme, and it's considered corny for an artist to do so, to match colors or to make a color themed exhibition. And I decided actually to make a color themed exhibition after I went to this hotel, and that exhibition was called Ancient Blue Ornaments, which is the show that's up in Atlanta for another week. It comes down, I think, this weekend. Sunday's the last day. Okay. It's actually fortunate that these two exhibitions overlapped, because it allowed me to make all new work for this show and not kind of ship anything over. You saw the photographs earlier. This is an older photograph that then I recontextualized with this painting on the wall. So each photograph, the entire edition of the photograph, all five are shown together. I still haven't decided how I would like for it to continue to live, whether I want to keep it all together or allow them to have their own lives. It would be interesting actually to have them each be able to go, but they have to keep their color with them. because it really does change the way that you see them. And the ancient blue ornament that the title comes from is a reference to Persepolis. The city of Persepolis has these architectural ornaments that are shaped exactly like this. But in this case, I've made them from MDF and coated it with formica or laminate. So it has, if you're not familiar with the material, it's the same material that this is made out of right here, this podium. It's the same material that you'll see in a lot of kitchen counters and tables. It's that one of the early forms of plastic, a very hard, durable plastic. So I want the sculptures to have the feeling of of being somehow kind of like furniture, or somehow sculpture, or somehow ornaments, architectural ornament. I had initially planned to have one in the bookstore and have things on it. They closed the bookstore and the museum, so that wasn't an option. It was an independent bookstore in the museum, and I think they moved. I'll start saying less so that I can leave time for Q&A. And something else I should talk about is that as I started making these sculptural works and they started finding their ways into a museum context, as many of you know, the galleries are pretty chill about precarious artworks, let's say. Museums have a very different responsibility than the gallery. So there is this idea that the works need to be protected from the public. And it's in a way, it's such a shame because oftentimes, they're pretty elegantly done here, actually, with those bars. But oftentimes you have those stanchions with the little stretchy rope that goes across, and that just drives me crazy. And they always want to put it around my work, and I always say no. And so I kind of thought, there has to be another solution. Like, what if we made the barrier kind of a part of the work itself? What if the barrier was another sculpture that had a function somehow as a sort of fence, as a sculptural object, and as a barrier? The first thing was that the space of the Atlanta Contemporary is quite awkward. It has this rectangle that seems to have this extra triangular bit to it. And you can see where years ago they had built a wall to kind of regulate the space. I reclaimed that wall. You could see the line. And I put a carpet there so that carpet was kind of an indication of an area that was separate from the rest of the space. Initially, I had thought to put that kind of barrier all the way across, but I thought, well, a carpet's meant for walking on, so I should have a moment where one can walk on the carpet. So actually, while I was in the space, I changed my mind and kind of built the barrier so that it allowed you to kind of walk in certain areas. And those are the ancient, what was it called? Ancient blue ornaments. I mean, you could tell, people like Scarpa were looking at stuff like this. And I think it's always good to have a bit of a sense of humor, as much as I talk about a critique of Orientalism, it's interesting to kind of test my own limits and kind of tease out the Orientalist in myself or in the viewer in a way that's not so serious. So this one's called Afghan Dream, Afghan Dream, you would say. The carpet's actually from Afghanistan, and there are at the very top, where the shisha has the tray, there are little pieces of lapis lazuli from Afghanistan as well. I can stop here, or I can give you a little bit of a preview of what's going to be in the galleries. I'll show this one because this painting's been removed from the show. I'll show you two paintings that have been removed. Often I find it useful to take something out and sometimes take two things out. They're much better in person, so it's not too far from here. And this one's called Green Movement. So I hope that was interesting enough, more interesting for you than it was for me. But let me know if there's any questions, and I could flip back through the images too. And if there are no questions, that's perfectly fine too. I won't be offended.
You talked about taking risks in the gallery in Switzerland. Can you comment on what that risk was?
Yeah, I think that that's a very good question. I think that some of the things that, when you're, it was an art fair. So, when you're doing an art fair, the easiest thing is to hang some of your most expensive work, several of them, as close as you can get them together and as many as you can fit in together without it looking ridiculous, and sometimes looking ridiculous. And try to kind of maximize sales. When you do something in an art fair that is more akin to something you do in a museum, it's a little more risky, and you're not guaranteed to have sales when there's something like that where the stripes are on the wall. Do they say, well, do the stripes come with the work? Like, what do we do? Are you going to come over and do the exhibition design? And I will, but, it just becomes a little bit more difficult, yeah. Okay, there's someone back there.
Fascinating talk, thank you. It's very, very interesting. I love your work.
Thank you.
But my question is, you showed your paintings in all these different variosphere architectural environments and look very wonderful, but like a Persian carpet perhaps, they find themselves in homes, in offices, in restaurants, in different kinds of environments. Do you encourage this? You said one painting, I might let it go, but it has to come with the blue. How do your works, your paintings, which seem beautiful and very rich, how do they find themselves into different kinds of environments, private environments?
That's a really good question. Honestly, I'm not one of those artists that's fussy about where the work goes in terms of, controlling the environment. I think part of understanding the role of painting and art in general is something that lives in a variety of contexts, is understanding that it often resides in a domestic environment and sometimes an institutional environment that's not public. Most of the time it's really, I'm interested in seeing how someone positions it. One of the slides that I didn't include was the collector in Connecticut, who recently passed away, Melva Buxbaum and Raymond Learcy. One of the moments where I really recognized my paintings as a backdrop was that one of my older paintings was in their collection, and there was a Homa Baba sculpture quite close to it, in front of it, and I just thought it was fantastic, and so I'm open to that kind of thing, as long as somebody doesn't hang it upside down or sideways, I trust that some people have aesthetics that are mine and some people have aesthetics that are theirs and I'm less interested in, but yeah, ideally, you would have some control over that, but I understand that you don't, and that's okay.
Could you talk a little bit about, or maybe there's more to say here, but I'm intrigued by the fact that Said's Orientalism is 1978-79, and you were born in 1978. Mm-hmm. Do you consider that work in relationship to your birthday, to you?
I mean, there are so many things that one can do. I mean, it goes into like Midnight's Children. I don't know if you're familiar with Salman Rushdie's book. The guy that was born during the partition, the moment of partition. He was born at midnight. I was born also the day that my family's from Isfahan, but I was born in Shiraz, and I was born during the day that martial law was declared in Isfahan. And so I was born into the revolution. I was born the same year as Edward Said's Orientalism. I was born the same year that Carlos Scarpa died. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, but...
when you did that series where you only used images from 78...
Before 78, yeah, there's a form of nostalgia there, which is, the longing for a period that's not your own, which is something that's quite common in popular culture as well. Yeah. I find it fascinating because I'm finally old enough that, like, you know, when kids are obsessed with 90s music, I find it really interesting. You know, it's so fascinating that 90s music is having a moment right now. Yeah. It's good. They deserve it. It was good music.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Thank you.